It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Before there was World War Z, before Zombieland or Resident Evil, and even The Walking Dead television series, there was George Romero and his iconic Night of the Living Dead. The film revolutionized the horror film genre, and now Romero's archives will be saved and on display through the University of Pittsburgh's library system. Adam Lowenstein is an associate professor of film studies at Pitt and a big Romero fan. Adam, welcome back to The Confluence.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's start right off with what's in the collection.
The collection is a treasure trove on many different levels. There's everything from unproduced scripts to working scripts that George actually has his annotated notes in. There's masks, there's props, there's the monkey from Monkey Shines. Pretty much anything you can imagine Romero-related is represented in this collection.
Have you gotten to explore yet?
Not as much as I would like because the acquisition is still brand new, but I have a sense of what's in it, and I know that there's not enough years left in my lifetime to go through it all in the way that I would like.
What does that mean in the context of what we're talking about?
It means I would probably have to come back as a zombie and
to continue your studies.
Do my research properly. Yes.
Okay. Any hidden treasures that you found that maybe you didn't even know about?
One of the things that's most exciting to me about this collection is that because George was the kind of filmmaker he was, which means he was fiercely dedicated to his independence as a filmmaker, it means that there were stretches of years in his career where he wasn't making films that people could see, but he was writing all the time. Mm-hmm. And there was all kinds of projects that were in development that never quite saw the light of day because the deal couldn't work out quite the right way. So we have a chance to see his career in an entirely new light.
Much of what we know about George Romero is because of Night of the Living Dead. How did that first big film go from, say, a cult classic status to being a more widely accepted and acknowledged film?
It was just one of those cases of George and his colleagues sort of tuning in to the times in a way that was the right film at the right time in the right context. And it just lit a fire underneath everything that was going on in American culture in that very turbulent time, 1968. This is the Vietnam era, right. The civil rights era. And George and his colleagues really channeled that in a way that resonated with the public in ways that I don't think any of them could have planned in their conscious minds. But in their unconscious minds, I think they were fully aware of what they were up to.
A moment ago, I used the term revolutionized the horror film genre. Is that overstating the influence?
Not at all. I mean, there's really no way to understand not only the modern horror film, but independent American cinema without understanding Night of the Living Dead and its importance. I mean, we couldn't have movies like we have today, like Jordan Peele's Us or Get Out or Guillermo del Toro's Shape of Water. These are all socially conscious horror films that were forged in the tradition of George Romero, which he showed us first and foremost in Night of the Living Dead, but that he pursued across his career in ever more sophisticated and ambitious ways.
His work wasn't just scary. There were other important elements. You just used the term socially conscious. And before that, you were talking about this was the era of the Vietnam War, of civil rights. That was an important part of his filmmaking?
Oh, absolutely. There's no way to understand George without understanding not only horror, but horror as a lens to think about social issues, political issues, cultural issues. He really was thinking about the world in an ambitious way and using horror as the lens for us to understand things that we might not want to look at otherwise.
All right, we see his films, we're scared, but yet there's some humor in them.
Oh, absolutely. And it would be a mistake to shortchange the humorous elements, because I think part of Romero's genius is that he enables the audience to join him, and his films are not they're not standoffish. They really invite you inside, and part of that is the thrill of the scare and the laugh of the humor.
You know, people, I think they go into some horror films and they expect to be scared. With Romero, could your expectations be beyond that then?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, to walk into a George Romero film is to really experience life in a broad sense. And that includes the things that frighten us, the things that make us laugh, the things that make us think, and the things that cause us to reflect on why are we all here in the first place.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking with Pitt Associate Professor of Film Studies, Adam Lowenstein, about Pitt receiving the archives of the late filmmaker George Romero. Who's donating these?
The collection comes from a three-part donation. The donors are Suzanne Romero, George's widow, Tina Romero, George's daughter, and Peter Grunwald, who's George's business partner and friend.
Mm-hmm. In fact, George's daughter said in a statement, quote, "I'm so excited for people to discover some of the treasures I grew up with." So having the archives in Pittsburgh seems appropriate, right? Because George Romero put Pittsburgh on the map, at least when it comes to zombies.
Well, and not just zombies. I mean, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that George Romero, for the 50 years that he was in Pittsburgh, was a sort of one-man film industry. And almost everyone who's still in Pittsburgh working on film has some connection to George, either directly, they trained with him, they worked on his films, or they're trained by the people who worked with George on his films. So film in Pittsburgh is just not conceivable without George.
So scholars such as yourself will have access. What do you want to learn?
I'm most excited to learn about what George's career can tell us about what it means to be an independent American filmmaker with an investment in horror, working, you know, from the early 60s all the way through the 2000s. And I think we don't know that whole story just through the films that we've seen. We need to understand what the independent creative process is like, and the sort of the hurdles and compromises that George had to deal with to maintain his vision. And those things happen in the unseen aspects of his career, not just the things on the screen.
Mm-hmm. How might exploring these archives, seeing those script notes that you alluded to earlier, be more than a glimpse of filmmaking of the past and actually maybe inspire some young filmmakers of today?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, I'm a professor and I can't wait to let my students loose in the archive and have them really sort of think about, you know, their own dreams and aspirations as filmmakers coming up against the realities of what George faced and how he problem solved and how he forged ahead, even when things were very much against him in terms of the odds. And times have changed, of course, and filmmaking technology has changed. But I think the passion to establish an independent vision in film is still something that animates filmmakers, young filmmakers today, as much as it animated George in the very beginning and all the way to the end of his career.
So being able to see, being able to read those script notes could be very interesting about his thought process as the project was proceeding along or maybe having some hitches to it?
Absolutely. I mean, many of the projects that are documented in the archive are in multiple versions. We can see the scripts proceeding from very early drafts to shooting scripts and beyond. And it's a fascinating thing to watch a process occur in that way. And it's also not just the scripts. I mean, the promotional materials, the interviews, the photographs, the props, the memorabilia. It's all part of the story because a film is not just what you see on the screen. It's everything around it. It's everything that went into making it. It's everything that exists as people make meaning out of it.
All right. We've talked about scholars such as yourself. We've talked about filmmakers. What about us? What's in it for the fans? What can the fans be able to see?
I think this is just as much a treasure trove for fans as it is for scholars or students or aspiring filmmakers, because there's so many things that would be just as much at home in a museum as in an archive. You know, things that you want to see and touch and look at rather than study necessarily. And Pitts-Hillman Library is planning to put these things on display in a way that everyone can see them.
A lot of the fans of horror and zombie films weren't even alive when Night of the Living Dead was released. Do you think they might look at the archives and say, hey, I see a similarity, an element of a movie today and what Romero was doing 50 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in many ways, we live in the world that George created in the sense of zombie culture. I mean, think about Game of Thrones, you know, the most popular television show ever created. And the zombies in that show are central to the show's arc and would be unthinkable without George's model.
Okay, we have less than a minute left. When will this collection be available?
There'll be access beginning in the fall in terms of an exhibition at Hillman Library at the University of Pittsburgh, a gala celebration in October that will celebrate the arrival of the archive. And it won't be fully accessible, but there'll be enough sort of teasers there for people to start to get a sense of what is there.
And briefly, what should we see first?
You should see the zombie head, because that's where all good ideas come from.
A zombie's head. Adam Lowenstein is an associate professor of film studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Pitt's library system is receiving the archives of iconic filmmaker George Romero. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Depression experienced by workers has been estimated to cost the U.S. economy more than $200 billion annually. A new initiative is helping CEOs improve support in the workplace to benefit their employees and their bottom line. Pennsylvania's Supreme Court has 6 weeks to decide whether to extend a consent decree so that Highmark insurance carriers can continue seeing UPMC doctors at in-network rates. And just ahead, one of the city's only queer youth theater programs premieres its multimedia stage production this weekend. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Environmental officials this week ordered a pipeline company to restore streams it illegally eliminated while building in Beaver County. Officials say Energy Transfer jettisoned 23 streams by filling them with soil. The discovery was made during an investigation of a pipeline explosion that happened in September. And the Penn Trafford School District received flack after video emerged of an active shooter training that took place in January. The video appears to show an actor wearing a Middle Eastern headdress. The district says organizers didn't intend to portray the shooter as Arab or Muslim. Find more stories online at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Chasing Elevation is a multimedia stage production created and performed by members of the theater group Dreams of Hope. The organization is one of the only LGBTQ+ theater companies in the country. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports on how the showcase reflects the experiences and cautious outlook of the students who wrote it.
It's the year 2064. Climate change has become fully realized, and survivors must adapt to their chaotic new environment. The show opens with an anthem, sung by Isai Eloquovrella, and slowly more characters meander to the front of the darkly lit blue stage.
Ice caps are melting, mountains freezing over, hurricanes destroying half the land. Building up momentum, colliding and collecting, soon there will be nothing left.
This is how Chasing Elevation begins. 17-year-old Josh Begler says the first few scenes establish the dystopian world fairly quickly.
We're pretty much at, like, imminent disaster at this point. We're all underwater except for the high up, at, like, higher elevation, all of the places that a lot of celebrities live in, very wealthy.
That wealthy land is New America. It's where protagonists Jamie and Scarlett find themselves washed up in their futuristic boat. They're unlikely but very much in love partners who watch other survivors on a path toward New America.
And one of the protagonists is not very happy about that because they recognize how bad New America is if it's so classist.
Economic inequities, environmental irresponsibility, and harmful capitalistic societies may seem like hefty themes for a show written by middle and high schoolers, but Begler says these ideas are very real in students' minds.
I feel like this is an issue that definitely a lot of teens relate to. I think we're very afraid because it seems like we're going to be the generation that kind of experiences in our adulthood all of these changes.
Projected on the wall throughout the show are commercials, much like the ads that pop up before YouTube or Facebook videos. One features Papa John, yes, that Papa John, who has run a successful political career based on nationalistic values.
A vote for Papa is a vote for strong borders, good workers, good values, and great pizza!
While Chasing Elevation addresses these complicated issues, it does so through a queer lens. Characters identify across the LGBTQ spectrum. They talk about what pronouns they prefer on stage, and they tackle homophobia and transphobia. 13-year-old Isai Elekwovrela, who uses all pronouns, plays multiple characters in the show.
I think we need to, like, break the boundaries and create spaces for all people of all genders and all sexual orientations.
Representation is important, Elekwovrela says, and there's not enough of it. It's part of why Dreams of Hope began in the first place, to provide a space where queer and trans youth can be around each other. Here, they're free to discuss and create media that reflects their ideas and fears, away from schools or people that might reject them. Pittsburgh Kappa High School senior Red Goblet has been in the Dreams of Hope program for years.
It's going to be our world. Like, we are the ones rising. We are the ones who are going to live with it. It's going to be us.
But Chasing Elevation is not all about hard realities. It's funny, too, with jokes about sentient artificial intelligence and puns galore. For the students performing, this stage is their place to talk about their identity, their anxieties, and their hopes. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Chasing Elevation by Dreams of Hope will be performed today through Sunday at the Kelly Strayhorn Theater. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's District 9 City Council race is a crowded one. 90.5 WESA's Ariel Worthy reports that five residents are running, including incumbent Ricky Burgess. Most candidates are focusing on affordable housing issues and transparency in the office.
Ricky Burgess says it takes years to become the councilor he is and to form the connections he's made over the past 12 years. He says that's what the district could lose if he wasn't reelected.
I think that not only do I have a proven track record, but I'm in position that over the next 4 years, I will be able to multiply our success.
The district includes Homewood, Larimer, Garfield, Point Breeze North, and part of East Liberty. Burgess says as counselor, his goal has been to reduce violence and to bring more economic development. Violent crime has dropped citywide over the last 15 years, and more housing development has come to the district. Still, issues of gentrification remain a concern. Burgess says going forward, new development will prioritize current residents so they aren't displaced.
But you build affordable housing first, and then you bring in market rate housing. By building the affordable housing first, you protect the residents.
Cheryl Lee Fuller isn't buying it. That's partly because 12 years ago, her mother was pushed out when a public housing complex in Homewood was torn down.
My mother was one of those when they brought that building down. And those seniors and those individuals in that building were told, we're going to tear this down and bring you back. A lot of them didn't make it back.
Fuller is a retired Port Authority employee and says she'll focus more closely on housing affordability than Burgess has. Karen Young is 26 years old and lives in Stanton Heights. His father ran against Burgess in 2015. Young says he's running this year because he does not think Burgess is available to the community. So one of his focuses would be on upgrading park facilities so young people would have a place to go.
I really do believe that when you have activities for people and other things for them to get involved in, they won't just be hanging out on a specific corner. A lot of it is young people who do not have anything else to do.
Judith Ginyard's name is almost as familiar as Burgess on the ballot. This is her fourth time running, and she says the district needs loyalty, accountability, and transparency. She faults Burgess for using a nonprofit called the Poise Foundation to help decide where to spend community development money in the district.
Have nothing against the nonprofit foundation. I think that they do excellent work. But we're talking about public money. And public money needs to go through a very public process.
A spokesperson at Burgess's office says Poise screens applicants for their eligibility for the funds. Burgess does this because his predecessor left office after pleading no contest to charges of misspending public funds. Stefan Braxton does apartment maintenance at a housing development for senior citizens. He decided to run for council when he didn't get a response to requests from the city. His decision was partly because he thinks Burgess doesn't focus enough on seniors.
He's concerned about the violence and everything, and I'm also concerned about that too, but it seems like he's forgetting about the senior citizens. That's what I want to work on.
Burgess is backed by his fellow city councilors, and he's been endorsed by Democratic Party committee members. He's only narrowly won re-election before and has benefited from facing split opposition. The primary election is on May 21st. I'm Ariel Worthy, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Mental illness doesn't just affect individuals and families. It also impacts where people work. Depression costs the U.S. economy an estimated $210 billion per year in absenteeism, lost productivity, and medical costs. One organization is taking action to address that problem. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, Keystone PA, has launched CEOs Against Stigma. It's an initiative to help employers make improvements in the workplace to support employees living with mental illness. 90.5 WESA's Maria Scapoletto spoke with NAMI's CEO Christine Michaels and the executive director of the Stoughton Farm Foundation, Joni Schwager.
Christine, with depression costing businesses so much, why have CEOs been slow to address this problem?
I think that it's because of the stigma. I think that it's not out in the open enough. I mean, some of them have employee assistance programs, and I think that a lot of them thought that was enough. But I think that they're learning now that the stigma is very, very damaging. I mean, if you're in the workplace, we know this from personal testimony, people are very, very reluctant to admit that they have any type of mental health problem in the workplace because they fear their job. They fear they'll be viewed differently. And I think that the CEOs I think they want to know more about mental illness in the workplace. And I think they want to make a difference within their employees and their employees' families, but they didn't know how to do it. And I think that's the purpose of our program. What we're offering is to have them be more knowledgeable about mental illness, period, and then be able to understand better why it's happening in the workplace, why it affects the workplace, and that there are things that they could do to address it.
Your organization has been an advocate for those with mental illness for years, but does your message or methodology change when you're helping people in the workplace?
I don't think so. Our basic message is that mental illness is extremely common, it's treatable, and recovery is possible. And, you know, I can't guess how many people out there living with a mental illness and are very successful. They're productive. They're happy. And that's, that's our message that, but the stigma, that's our other message, though, that the stigma is that damaging and that it has to be stomped out. I mean, we always have an anti-stigma theme going or project going or no matter what we do, we're always bringing up the anti-stigma component, the damage that stigma does.
So tell me, how will this program then, this CEOs Against Stigma specifically, how are you going to make this work in the workplace for the companies that invite you in? How do you take away that fear from the employee that really wants to be helped but is afraid to reach out?
Well, first of all, the objective of CEOs Against Stigma is to have the leaders, the top executives in the company embracing this and leading this change in the company. And that sends a stronger message than if it were middle management. It has to come from the top. And we have different types of presentations and trainings we have to offer. We have the pledge that we are asking the CEOs to sign, and that signifies their commitment to this. And we have materials for them. We have a memorandum that they can issue to their employees in the workplace to sort of kick this off.
I want to bring in Joni Schwager, Executive Director of the Staunton Farm Foundation, which has agreed to fund the CEOs Against Stigma project for the next 3 years. Welcome, Joni.
Thank you.
Joni, what drew you to this program at NAMI specifically?
Well, firstly, I'd like to say that we have been a partner with NAMI on a number of projects over the past at least 20 years and have always been interested in how we can keep people healthy in any stage of their life and in any environment.
Why do you feel so passionately about addressing mental health stigma in the workplace?
Well, we want people to understand that behavioral health is health. It's not separate from health. Our heads are connected to our bodies. And so we understand that a lot of companies are interested in wellness these days. They have been providing nutritional help, smoking cessation, increasing your exercise as part of their healthy workforce plans, and we think that behavioral health should be part of it.
And is it important also to kind of give employees a roadmap, a clear roadmap on how they can proceed with, obtaining help in the workplace? Some of them may be confused about their, for example, their health insurance plans and how to navigate that.
And that's why this is more important than ever, because it's very complex navigating the behavioral health system. It's very hard to find a provider. It's very hard to get immediate access, and any way that the workforce and employers can help us to get their employees in treatment or at least provide some resources, we think just helps everyone.
Back to you, Christine. The initiative just launched recently locally. How many people are participating right now, and how many are you hoping for?
Well, we had an excellent turnout. We held our kickoff breakfast, and we had 40 different companies represented there. And out of that day, we had 6 different companies sign the pledge and want to go forward with us. And then also since then, one of the companies reached out to us, and they want to beef up their whole mental health, everything in the workplace. They asked us about bringing in a training that we don't do, but we can facilitate it getting there into the workplace.
From those folks who are participating or who have participated in your kickoff, what kind of feedback are you getting from them regarding mental health among their employees? What are their biggest concerns that they're seeing in the workplace?
Well, I think it's the lack of productivity, the loss of productivity, the absenteeism, and I think just the overall, the retention, a lot of times they lose people, and it makes so much better business sense to invest in people and help them and get through this. And And I think that you know, the companies that we're interacting with all have, I think, a genuine sense of compassion for their employees. They're, you know, this is what I think is driving them more than anything.
What if someone's listening right now who is not a CEO but thinks their workplace could benefit from this program? What can they do?
I think they should go to their HR director, their human resource department, and just talk about it and sort of introduce the topic, and see what kind of reaction they get. They certainly can have their human resource department contact us. And we'd be very happy to explain the program to them.
Are you getting any high-profile local leaders on board so far?
Yes. Mayor Peduto intends to sign the pledge next week, and we were invited to come and participate in that signing, and we're absolutely thrilled.
How important is it for all leaders of organizations to address this problem? This isn't just a problem in the corporate arena. This can be addressed in nonprofit organizations and governmental organizations and so on.
Yes. I mean, it's this way in the world. I mean, the 50% of mental illness goes untreated. And the primary reason for that is stigma. Two reasons: stigma or the lack of insurance. But stigma has that power to be that damaging that people do not seek treatment because of it.
And what is the most common form of mental illness that people suffer from in America?
I believe it's depression and then anxiety.
And do you think some folks who might have an anxiety problem, they might think that there's really no help out there for them because they might not have a serious problem that, you know, might not warrant, you know, hospitalization or whatnot?
Absolutely. That's why we're trying to focus on this and other projects that helps people, what I would say, normalize mental illness, because it is so common. It's chronic. It's like diabetes. It's like cancer, you know. Not diseases you want to have, but they're very common. Some of them are treatable, certainly in the case of mental illness. Mental illness is treatable, and people can recover and do.
Finally, I mean, if someone is reluctant to seek treatment on their own, if they receive help through their employer, this undoubtedly might have, you know, a positive effects on families and communities as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, it is considered a family illness. If someone in your immediate family is living with a mental illness, that affects the whole entire family. And even if you're an employee and the person in your family isn't you, it's your wife or one of your children, that is just as, you know, I don't want to say damaging, but it is just, it has the same type of outcome or impact that actually having the depression does. You're at work and you're preoccupied because of your wife's illness, or you're missing work because of your wife's illness. It's, you know, it's not just always the employee. Many times it's the employee's family.
Thanks to both of you for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was The Confluence's Maria Scappellitto talking with Christine Michaels, the CEO of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Keystone, and Joni Schwager, the executive director of the Staunton Farm Foundation. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court now has 6 weeks to decide whether to extend a relationship between UPMC and Highmark that would treat patients at either system regardless of the insurer. WESA's health reporter Sarah Bowden was in court yesterday in Harrisburg, and that's where we find her this morning. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Kevin.
So, Sarah, remind us, please, what is at stake for Highmark customers if this consent decree is not extended beyond June 30th?
Well, they lose access to the physicians that they've been seeing for, in some cases, decades. So they have to form entirely new medical relationships with new physicians, which, as anyone can tell you, is kind of a pain in the neck.
Mm-hmm. So do they lose complete access, or can they keep those but have to pay a higher rate, the out-of-network, well, so-called?
I mean, I guess technically they could keep seeing their physician, but they wouldn't be able to cover any of that medical care with insurance, which, as anyone will tell you, is a lot of money.
And so they would have to, for the most part, look for other providers then, as you say.
Yeah, and they would go to Allegheny Health Network, which, you know, has a lot of great providers. But, you know, there are lots of circumstances where someone might want to continue seeing a UPMC doctor or see a specific UPMC doctor.
This consent decree, it goes back 5 years, I believe, and was actually forced upon them by government, correct?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate description.
So what was at the heart of why this consent decree came about 5 years ago?
To prevent chaos, so people wouldn't just be abruptly cut off from their doctors and other medical providers, to provide a transition period, which UPMC argues, you know, everyone knew this was coming. This was a transition period that had been planned. There was 5 years. This, you know, and therefore the contract should end. The consent decree should end. So there had been lots of time to plan.
Mm-hmm. So the idea was that UPMC wanted to do this 5 years ago, basically, correct?
Yeah. And this 5 years was provided again for a period of transition.
That consent decree, as we said, was instituted by the government, by the then Attorney General, and by Governor Corbett. So why does Attorney General Shapiro want to extend that relationship?
Well, to hear the Attorney General tell it, you know, there was the hope that something more permanent would be established, some other sort of contract between UPMC and Highmark, sometime within these past 5 years, and that just hasn't happened. And so I think that you could argue that, I think that what's happening here is that UPMC says, you know, we were never intending to do that, but the Attorney General's like, well, no, like, this was always in the plan. So everyone has their own kind of version of the story of what they thought was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to the oral arguments that you heard yesterday. What was the gist of the two sides' arguments?
Well, the Attorney General's office argued that the Supreme Court has just a very narrow sort of thing to decide, which is whether or not to extend the consent decree. And UPMC is arguing this is actually like taking, making big changes, because the consent decree was always supposed to end at the end of next month. And this is just taking a very specific kind of vague clause and giving it this sort of crazy, sort of unlimited power. And so they're both framing it in almost like mirror image or very opposite ways.
All right, we have less than a minute left. You covered the Commonwealth Court decision back in April, where Commonwealth Court said it could not be extended. Were there any new arguments presented to the High Court yesterday?
I wouldn't say new arguments, but I did find it very interesting that the focus wasn't so much on UPMC's charitable mission, but really about when a consent decree should end, if that's a fundamental aspect to an agreement, or if that can be lengthened, or if that's something that can be modified. It was like pretty nerdy legal stuff that a lot of people who are watching oral arguments were super into, and that was kind of fun.
Okay, just a couple of words. Did the High Court give any indication when? Would it happen before the 6 weeks as far as a ruling?
They did not give any indication, but again, if they rule in favor of the Attorney General's office, then they have to issue something within the next 5 weeks or 6 weeks.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health reporter. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich and Julia Maruka. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a great weekend of good news.